This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We'll hear from Larry Carter, president of the Louisiana Federation of Teachers, largest teacher union in Louisiana. He'll comment on educators having guns in classrooms and pay raises for teachers. Also, Deanna Wallace, the director of legal communications of Americans United for Life, on the federal judicial appointment of Louisiana's Kyle Duncan, who at age 46 was approved on a 50-47 vote yesterday by the U.S. Senate, both Louisiana senators voting for Kyle Duncan. John Kennedy expressed reservation early, but then gave a full-throated endorsement of this LSU graduate. Pulitzer Prize winner Gilbert King will discuss the violence, race, and justice lost during the Jim Crow era. His latest book, Gilbert King's, is about a 1957 murder in Florida beneath a ruthless sun. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And a reminder that this is now day 7 of the Spring Member Fest, and we'd like to hear from you. If you value this hour of programming, please give us a call and let us know your appreciation. We certainly would like that immensely. The number is 855-893-9753. I had the pleasure of hosting a show at this time on WRKF for about 11 years and have been back now for more than 1 year, and it is always a pleasure to share the microphone with the most enlightened audience in radio. Enlightened because the people who listen to this station generally are those who really are into what's going on in our world, and there is much happening, as we know, and we provide a forum for discussion about local, national issues that are of interest to you. And if you would like to give us a call, we would like it a lot. 855-893-9753, 855-893-9753. We start with Larry Carter. He's now in his second year as president of the Louisiana Federation of Teachers, the largest teacher union in Louisiana. Approximately how many members, Larry?
We approximately have 20,000 members.
20,000 teachers. We're going to discuss a few matters with him, but of course one right now that is continuing to gain a lot of attention in light of the Parkland tragedy a few months ago is guns in schools, particularly teachers having guns. The governor of Louisiana says he's against that, and his wife is an educator. And the legislature to this point has been reluctant to embrace this as well. But today in committee, there is House Bill 602 to be heard as we speak in the Criminal Justice Committee. It would allow people with concealed carry permits to bring guns into schools. Your thoughts about this one, Larry Carter?
Yeah, first I would say congratulations to you, Jim. We understand that on April 13, you were introduced, inducted into the LSU Alumni Hall of Distinction. So
thank
we want to
say
congratulations
you.
To you. Yeah, this is a bill by Representative Magez, HB 602. It's a bill that would allow anyone with concealed carry permits to walk onto school grounds, and we think that's dangerous for public education.
Why?
Well, when you think about it, the state's gun-free zone laws were established to give law enforcement a tool to ensure that something can be done about a person wielding a gun or near a school even before violence actually occurs. So we think to have a person with a concealed carry permit, not knowing, you know, their purpose for being at the school, to walk into a building could scare teachers and students.
877-217-5757 is your number. That's 877-217-5757 in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, and talk at talklouisiana.org. For Larry Carter, president of the Louisiana Federation of Teachers. Now, there are those who believe that when you have these signs, gun-free zone, it's an invitation to people up to no good. How do you answer those people?
I summarily reject that notion that because you have a gun-free zone that it allows criminals to say this is open season on our students and open season on personnel who work in those buildings. We believe it's there for a purpose, like I stated earlier. Think about it. You go into a school as a resource officer or a police officer where there's a gun said to be on campus. And when you look, there's a person, what most people say, a good person with a gun, and the police cannot distinguish in that split second who's actually in there to do harm and who's in there to, quote-unquote, protect themselves or protect others. So we think the gun-free zone is an adequate way for resource officers and police officers, when they do respond to a call from a school that says there is an active shooter on the premises, that they won't mistakenly shoot, quote unquote, the good person with a gun.
Now, Governor Edwards says he is in favor of armed guards at schools. In fact, these schools that have multiple students, he was commenting that his hometown has 2,000 people, but it has more than one police officer. Mm. He would like several guards at some of the larger schools. Is that a good idea?
Look, it's a great idea. In fact, I was just appointed, and there's a group of individual stakeholders around this issue, state police officers, school personnel, and myself, labor union leaders. But the governor just called into a group of, I guess it's called the Blue Ribbon Commission on School Safety. And one of the things that we talk about is how do we keep schools safe? And one of the biggest issues I know that we have as an organization is that we do believe you should have armed personnel who's certified, who's been in extensive training. Their jobs are to protect the citizens of this state. To have individuals, because they have a concealed carry permit or because they had limited training, should be given that opportunity. We summarily, again, reject that option and believe that school resource officers and police officers, trained officials in the law enforcement business, should be there to help protect us.
There were armed guards in Parkland, according to reports, and they did not, at least one of them, did not act appropriately, and they did not rush the room where this tragedy was happening. President Trump says he would have gone in unarmed if he had had the opportunity. What is the protocol for teachers? Do you have any kind of a blueprint if something like some terrible action like this were to occur in Louisiana?
I think most schools prepare their teachers and students by saying, let's hunker down in a school particular building, in a particular room, lock doors, and the teachers become a shield between them and their students and making sure that they're safe. In terms of resource officer, I was saddened to hear that a resource officer or school support personnel who actually was trained to do that did not feel that was, his first or her first priority to go into that building. But at the same time, I do believe there's ways in which we can better secure our schools. If you think about that particular school, it was an open access school. You didn't have one point of entry. You had multiple points of entry into this large campus. We do believe that arming resource officers with better training when it comes to this particular mass shooting, occurrence. But also, how do we actually structure our buildings and our facilities that allow one point of access and having, maybe metal detectors and a guard that stands at that particular position to make sure that those individuals who are supposed to be in the school are there and those who are not supposed to be in the schools don't enter?
Well, a listener, Holly, in the Garden District asked about this tragedy in Nashville over the weekend. It did not involve a school, but it involved a Waffle House, and a lot of people go to Waffle House. And how do you guard against something like this?
It's very difficult. I think there are signs that the community, that young man's parents, and I guess individuals who understand that this man had a medical or a emotional problem, that somebody should have at least looked at how do you not only just take the guns away from him, but how do you get him the mental support that he needed in order to deal with the issues that he was dealing with. This is not the first time he's been identified. I think he was the same gentleman that went to the White House to, get into a conversation with, President Trump. I really believe when those signs are out there, we have to do a better job of dealing with the mental health issues as it relates to who gets guns and who does not get guns.
Well, if teachers were carrying guns every day of the year, things do happen in classrooms that are unpleasant. Does that invite the prospect for violence that would not have occurred otherwise?
I think it's a dangerous precedent to have any educator, instead of worrying about teaching and learning, they're worrying about being a police officer that had extensive training. It becomes a recipe for disaster. I just think about a time when if a student certainly acts out in a certain way that a particular teacher feels threatened, that she or he has to take that weapon, aim it at a student, and actually shoot a student, potentially not just shooting them and injuring them, but killing them, and to live with that burden of having to think that you actually killed a young person would be devastating to any adult. So I think that's a recipe for disaster, and we just don't want to see that happen.
You were a teacher at Murray Henderson Elementary on the West Bank of New Orleans, taught fourth and sixth graders.
That's correct.
7 years. Did you ever feel in danger?
I never felt in danger. In fact, I was teaching in one of the largest housing developments in New Orleans, and what most people would call a project. And I never felt threatened. There were instances where students would fight, and we can see outside in the community some parents may get into it. But I never felt unsafe. I really didn't. I felt that, for the most part, those issues was best left up to the authorities. So we would call the police if needed. Or we would have counselors at the school that would bring parents in or bring students in because they had the time to do that. Today, I think our school counselors are so burdened with doing testing and other issues, you know, relating to helping the school run, that they don't really get the time to really focus on helping and assisting mm-hmm. those students with mental and emotional challenges.
How do you answer people who say that you're just anti-gun, period? It's not just anti-teachers having guns. It's just you don't want any guns at all. Well, how do you answer that?
I answer, I've never owned a gun. I never had the feeling that I needed to own a gun, honestly. But I respect the fact that my uncles fought in wars.
Mm-hmm.
He owns guns. My best friends, they own guns. I am not anti-gun. I am not anti-Second Amendment. I am for listening to the teachers and school employees out there who tell us that would be a bad recipe for arming teachers.
877-217-5757 is the number for Larry Carter, president of the Louisiana Federation of Teachers. He'll be with us a little longer. WRKF is wrapping up Spring Member Fest. Just 14,000 left to gather for this fundraiser. And when we do that, we'll stop asking for your support for quite a while. Contribute today to help bring the campaign to a successful close, and you'll enter into a drawing for a first-generation Amazon Echo plus a $50 Amazon gift card. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Larry Carter, president of the Louisiana Federation for Teachers, is with us. 877-217-5757 is your number. 297-5633 in Baton Rouge. We go to Dan downtown. Hi, Dan. You're on the air with Larry Carter.
Yeah, Mr. Carter, given that the legislature won't even relieve teachers from paying for students' school supplies, how do you propose we get it to raise revenue to pay for armed guards?
Yeah, I think that's one of the questions that we struggle with as well in terms of revenue. I think there's conversations going on shortly about a special session that will deal with the budget issues. And I think when you look at those parishes that have actually been able to deal with this particular issue, they imposed conversations with the community around how do we generate revenue to actually pay for more armed guards, and they're doing that. And I think I was on this Blue Ribbon Commission committee meeting just about a week ago, and one of the parishes, I think it was Rapides Parish, that police sheriff superintendent, I believe he was able to go in and raise taxes to really pay for secured guards for not just public schools but also private and parochial. It's a model that's being looked at across the state, and so I think local parishes will have to take this issue up and determine whether or not they believe this is the path they want to take.
Today in the Advocate editorial column from Dan Fagan, he says the headline reads, "Teachers Union Show True Colors." House Bill 343 is what he's discussing. Mm-hmm. Fagan closes by saying, "More than half of Louisiana teachers do not belong to a union. Most teachers are about the kids, not the union. They understand the union will do whatever is necessary to maintain power, even if it means harassing teachers at work to join the union or back union-friendly candidates." That's five unions so far.
Mm-hmm.
"The fact that the two teachers' unions," writes Fagan, "are blocking legislation to protect teachers from harassment at the workplace should tell you all you need to know about their priorities." Your response, Larry Carter.
Look, I read that article, and I think Dan actually did us a favor. He exposed the real intent behind the bill favored by big business and other so-called nonpartisan groups. Big business has never shown any regards for teacher rights, and we were baffled by the sudden support for a bill that said it defends teacher rights. Fagan revealed the real reason big business is spending so much money and political capital on this bill is just another sad attempt by big business and their mouthpieces to silence the voices of teachers, school employees, and organizations they choose to be represented by. So-called nonpartisan groups who promote this bill are saying teachers want it in end to unions and school administrators harassing them at work into joining unions or engaging in political activities. These same groups support bills that take away teacher rights on an ongoing basis. The author of the bill, Steve Carter, he actually admitted during testimony that the bill doesn't have any teeth to it. And for the record, LFT, Louisiana mm-hmm. Federation of Teachers, LAE, Louisiana Association of Educators, together represent more than three-fourths of the teachers statewide. So I think we know what the majority of teachers and school employees are saying.
Fagan said more than half of the teachers don't belong to a union. He's mistaken.
Fagan may want to go back and look at his numbers, because there is another association out there that also, you know, go after organizing and, quote-unquote, representing teachers mm-hmm. and school employees that say they aren't a teachers union, but they're acting and operating just like a union, but they're claiming they're not. And then you have these other, quote-unquote, nonpartisan groups that are out there claiming mm-hmm. they're for teachers and for students. And when you look at their track record of the bills that they support, they're not supporting what teachers and school employees want. We have close to 20,000 members. The LAE has close to 20,000 members. And I can tell you, the other association, they do not. So they cannot say they represent half of, you know, the half. So it's not 50%. We represent almost three-fourths the two organizations of school teachers and employees in the state.
877-217-5757. Ali Baltazar producing. We'll go back to the phone lines in a moment with Larry Carter, president of LFT. What are the benefits? I suspect I'm preaching to the choir, but why should a teacher join the union?
Union? Most teachers and school employees join the unions to have a voice in the workplace. They feel like they come together, they want to form an organization that actually represents what's best for public education, for their students, and for themselves. So when people talk about we're going into schools and distracting classroom time, that is something that we preach to our staff. We do not do. Most of us come from the teaching workforce. We know how important it is not to disturb classrooms and certainly not to disturb the hardworking men and women who on a day-to-day basis teach our kids. So that is a fallacy that's being put out there by these, again, so-called nonpartisan groups, because they are very partisan when it comes to issues that they want to fight against and sometimes fight for that's not in the best interest of the school employees and the men and women that are working in our schools today.
All right. There's a story today that the Louisiana Federation of Teachers is polling its members to see what actions LFT would favor to address quality of life for teachers and students. What's going on here?
Yeah, we put out a survey probably a couple of months, maybe about a month ago, somewhere about a week. Oh, I'm sorry, it's been a week. I know we talked about it about a month ago, but we put it out because we were getting inquiries from our local leaders and also from school employees around the state. They've been seeing what was happening in other parts of the country, like in West Virginia, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Arizona. And so we thought, since people are inquiring about this issue, let's put a survey out and see how it's going. So because salaries and issues related to whether or not they have textbooks in the classroom, whether or not mm-hmm. students have the necessary materials they need to be successful, we're getting good responses from the survey. What we're finding is people are willing to really, at the last minute, take the stand and say, if our politicians and our, you know, whether local or statewide, don't see this as an issue of importance, we're willing to walk out.
So when will you release the findings of the survey?
We're probably going to be closing it soon, and once we do that, we'll certainly release that to the public, and we certainly have a copy of the survey here if you wanted to look at, you know, what kind of questions
sure.
they're, you know, we're asking. And we're really trying to get an authentic look at, from the classroom to the schoolhouse, what our teachers and school employees are saying about this particular issue. And so once those surveys come in, we'll certainly release that.
David in Atlanta. Hello, David. You're on the air with Larry Carter, president of LFT. Hi, David.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
To your guest, Jim, Paul Krugman had a column in the New York Times yesterday regarding states that have cut taxes to the detriment of public education. I'd like to know, how does your guest feel? And, of course, this is a partisan issue. Mm. The Republicans seem to have an affinity for cutting taxes to stimulate the economy. And, of course, it does nothing of the sort, tax cuts for the wealthy, to the detriment of public education. How would you address this problem to the general public to try to make people realize that we need to invest in education if this country is going to have a prosperous future. And the mentality of just cutting taxes for the wealthy to the detriment of health care and public education. How are we ever going to address this topic, sir, and educate the voters that the damage they're doing to the state of Louisiana?
All right, Larry?
Yeah, I mean, he hit on all the key points that we talk about on a day-to-day basis. Tax cuts for the sake of giving tax cuts to big business to stimulate growth in the economy does not always equate to better schools, better education for our kids. And so we take the position that there are taxes on the books for relief to big businesses that should be carefully looked at and scrutinized. You have ITEP bills, revenues that are being discussed at the local school board level right now to determine whether or not if a school district in a particular parish gives breaks to businesses, first of all, how many jobs are they creating? And are they contributing to the education of our kids? And so school boards now are challenged with giving a percentage of the monies, the relief, to businesses and tax reliefs. And so we believe strongly that we do have at a community level, at a school board level now, and even at a district level, determine how much taxes we are giving to these businesses.
We'll spend a few more minutes with Larry Carter, president of Louisiana Federation of Teachers. Your number 877-217-5757. And we'd like to hear from you. We're now about $13,000 or so dollars away from shutting down the Spring Member Fest. And if you contribute, we can get it done quickly. And this is the opportunity. 855-893-9753. 855-893-9753. Now let's pause for the news. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Deanna Wallace is on deck. She is the Director of Legal Communications with a group that is called Americans United for Life, and they are quite pleased with yesterday's vote to approve Kyle Duncan, a Baton Rouge native and LSU graduate, to a federal position on the federal bench. 877-217-5757, your number. We're wrapping it up with Larry Carter, president of LFT, the largest teacher union in Louisiana. Don at LSU. Hi, Don. You're on the air with Larry Carter.
Good morning, Mr. Inkster. Mr. Carter, I've been following this tax credit, or they call it the industrial tax credit, and other tax credits that industries along, particularly East Louisiana Parish and other parishes, they realize that these industries with lucrative profits are in their community. The schools are falling down, and they're not getting the money. In most of the river parishes, they're not getting the money that they feel that that should be coming to them.
All right. Thank you, Don.
Don, I think you're absolutely right. That's what I was just talking about. The school boards now are looking at having a say for the first time. Governor John Bel Edwards allowed school boards now to actually decide through a resolution process to decide what percentage of that tax break or that tax credit those businesses and those particular parishes get. So you have lobbyists, I'm sure, for business, and then you have those of us who are saying, you're in our communities, you have record high profits, it's time for you to help and assist us in educating our kids, and that means resources. That means if you used to get 100%, you now will be getting between 70% or maybe 80%, and 20% goes to, you know, educating our schools and getting infrastructure rebuilt. Or sometimes it's even as low as 50% in some parishes. So right now it's at the school board level. So if you're in a particular parish and you hear this issue come up, the ITEP, it's called ITEP, that's the tax credits for businesses and industry, you may want to go in and lobby your concerns. So I certainly thank you for the call.
Lastly, the average salary, according to your numbers for a teacher in Louisiana, is $49,745. What do you think the average salary should be?
Well, that's a tough question. I think, you know, we have to look at what, you know, actually we value in terms of how much we pay teachers and school employees. I would say if you're looking at a first-year teacher, if I had a magic number I can put out, I can say somewhere around $65,000, $70,000. and then it goes up from there. There's actually experimentation with salary and the benefits of having high salaries out of New York, where I've seen first and second year teachers making $115,000, and it's specially financed by a group that actually speaks to how, if we want to get the best and the brightest in education, we need to pay them a salary where they won't have to worry about can they afford to take care of their own families as well as take care of our families. So I would say to you, there's some experimentation going on with how high or how much is worth to us to pay teachers that kind of money.
Well, we'll have you back when the survey is completed, certainly, if you'll join us.
Certainly will.
All right.
Always.
Thank you, Larry Carter. Good
thank
to
you
see
so much,
you,
Jim.
And appreciate your time and your information.
Thank you so much.
Your number again is 877-217-5757. Also a reminder that we're, 23 minutes away from completing this hour, and we'd like to hear from you before the hour is over. Show your support for WRKF and for this program by calling 855-893-9753. With us now is Deanna Wallace. She is Director of Legal Communications with a group that is supportive of Kyle Duncan, who yesterday was confirmed to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, a big position for Kyle Duncan, 46 years old. Deanna's with Americans United for Life, and this is obviously a pro-life movement. Why was Kyle Duncan essential in your judgment to being on the Fifth Circuit?
Well, Jim, Kyle has decades of experience. He has a very profound respect for the Constitution and a scholarly approach to the law that really shows how conservatives view the role of the court, not as an activist that predicts his own opinion, but as someone who follows what the Constitution says and what the court says.
Well, if, for example, Kyle Duncan had been pro-choice, you would not be supporting him, would you?
We don't support judges based on their personal beliefs. We vote or we support them based on their actual judicial philosophy. The judicial philosophy of originalism would be our primary concern. Again, a pro-choice or pro-life judge isn't what we're looking for. It's someone that will respect the Constitution.
Okay, well, let's say Kyle Duncan said that I'm against abortion, I'm not going to have any part of it personally, but on the other hand, I believe that it is the constitutional right of a woman to have the right to choose to have one if she wants to. How would you come down on a nominee with that point of view?
I think, first of all, you're not going to get a nominee that says that because they're not allowed ethically to make that kind of statement about what a case that might come before them, which is one of the things that we saw in Kyle's actual hearing. Again, there's a difference between saying that you are pro-life in your personal beliefs and saying that you will follow the precedent of the court and whether or not you believe a court case was correctly decided. And so that would be something that would be our
all right.
Concern.
Well, what if he were to say Roe v. Wade was correctly decided?
If he believed Roe v. Wade was correctly decided, he wouldn't be an originalist that we would be interested in supporting because that's not the originalist approach. It's nowhere in the Constitution. It doesn't. It comes from penumbras and emanations.
Right.
That's kind of the judicial philosophy behind whether or not you are an originalist or an activist that can find rights within the Constitution that are not actually there.
But the Constitution has been interpreted many ways over the years. There was a time in this country when black people were not judged to be equal partners in society with white people, and that was a high court decision. Would you say that was correct, since it came from some of our early justices and might have been considered by some to be an originalist position?
Absolutely not, and I think that the pro-life side is the one that argues that precedence isn't the most important thing. It's not just what the court has interpreted in the past. It's how the Constitution actually was written. And I think that it's important to remember that the Supreme Court isn't an actually infallible body. They make mistakes, and we definitely believe that they made a huge mistake interpreting the Constitution to support the right to kill other human beings in the womb.
Deanna Wallace is with us, Americans United for Life. She's excited about Kyle Duncan, a Baton Rouge native and LSU law school graduate, who is going to be on the Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. It was a 50-47 vote, 50-47, almost along party lines. The only Democrat voting with the Republicans was Joe Manchin of West Virginia. John Kennedy, early on, the junior U.S. Senator for Louisiana, had expressed reservation about Kyle Duncan. Why do you think he changed his mind?
I think that once you really get a chance to talk to Kyle, to interact with him, it's very easy to see his scholarly approach and, you know, his temperament. And, you know, having been fortunate enough to see Kyle in action in the courtroom, in the classroom, I went to LSU Law as well. He visited there whenever I was in law school. He comes across as a very kind, considerate, and very thoughtful and academic whenever it comes to legal issues. And I think that it was just a matter of Kennedy getting a chance to see that.
We're visiting with Deanna Wallace, a few more minutes, Director of Legal Communications with Americans United for Life. Jim on Jones Creek. Jim, you're on the air with Deanna Wallace.
Hi, Deanna. I'm a little confused. So, first off, the Constitution, when it was written, very clearly defined that non-whites were not a full person. So anything beyond that, that would be judicial activism, correct?
No, there's no definition of whether or not person within the confines of the Constitution referred to only white men. That was not anything that was actually defined. And it's important to note that we didn't actually change the definition through the courts. We actually changed it with a constitutional amendment. So there was no judicial activism required to create or to clarify and make sure that we treated African Americans mm-hmm. with just as much respect as we do the white population.
Another listener, thank you very much, Jim. Another listener asks about Wendy Vitter. Are you also supportive of her being on the federal bench?
We are definitely supportive of Ms. Vitter. She has a long history of dealing with complex litigation. She was a prosecutor. She has represented the Archdiocese of New Orleans. She has plenty of experience to be a trial court judge, and we look forward to seeing her be confirmed as well.
And do you think it's a good chance she will be? She got into a little fracas at the beginning by saying she could not support or she would not, she really wouldn't take a position on Brown versus Board of Education. Has that one gone away, that particular controversy?
I think that that's, again, just a little bit of a misunderstanding on what ethically judges are allowed to say or potential judges are allowed to say about court cases. I think she was trying to be as best as she could to sidestep that ethical issue. But I think she made it really clear that, obviously, she doesn't believe in segregation and she wouldn't support segregation. It was just a little bit of an effort to be as conservative as possible in making sure that she didn't go over that line.
All right. Well, Deanna Wallace, we look forward to talking with you again. She's a Louisiana native, and she is with Americans United for Life as Director of Legal Communications. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back after this pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster, and our guest is Gilbert King. He was awarded a Pulitzer Prize in 2013 for Devil in the Grove, Thurgood Marshall, The Groveland Boys, and The Dawn of a New America. And he is back in a huge way with a book that is certainly resonating throughout our country, Beneath a Ruthless Sun, a True Story of Violence, Race, and Justice Lost and Found. And it's set in 1957 in Florida, where, as we know, like Louisiana, there were many racial issues going on. And that's a big part of your story, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Thanks, Jim, for having me. You know, it wasn't something I really set out to do after Devil in the Grove. I didn't really have any desire to go back into Lake County, Florida, and do another book. But I was doing a book talk there in 2012, and an elderly deputy came up to me, and he said, you know, you got your story right. because I was around back then, but you didn't get the whole story. There's more down here. And so we started talking, and he ended up telling me a story, he said, that still haunted him today. He said when his sheriff's department had framed an innocent kid for a rape that he did not commit. And when he started telling me, I said, well, this might make an interesting article, sort of a follow-up to Devil in the Grove. But the more and more I started researching it, the Freedom of Information Act requests that had been filled, I started to learn that this is a book in itself.
Well, Sheriff Willis McCall was a villain in your last book, and he's certainly front and center again.
Yeah, he is. And another reason, it's not something I really want to write about again. And I thought maybe going into it, maybe he'd be just a minor character that would be on the periphery of this case. But, you know, sure enough, the deeper I dug, the more I found out he was very much involved in this case. And his relationship with the female reporter in this, who's really the thorn in his side, Mabel Norris Reese and Willis McCall just go at it. This time, much more significantly than in the last book, so much so that Sheriff Willis McCall and the Klan were basically burning crosses on her yard. They were poisoning her dog. They bombed her house, and they basically drove her out of Lake County. But she just really would not quit on this case.
She was an amazing journalist, a crusader, Mabel Norris Reese, and this is a story largely about Jesse Daniels. Tell us about him.
Well, the interesting thing about this is that this sort of looks at race in a very different way. It's not what I expected, not what I think readers will expect going into it. But in December of 1957, Blanche Bosanquet Knowles was in her home with her three children. Her husband was away, and she was sexually assaulted and that evening. And she reported to police that her attacker was, quote, a husky Negro with bushy hair. And so Willis McCall and his deputies round up two dozen African Americans in this community, start interrogating them at the jail, and they settle on this one suspect who happens to be, coincidentally, the nephew of the civil rights activist in this particular town. But then something really odd happens in Lake County. The husband of Blanche comes home and starts meeting with the deputies in the sheriff's office, and suddenly all of the African-American suspects are released from jail, and Willis McCall sets his sights on a poor, mentally disabled white teenager named Jesse Daniels and accuses him of rape.
And the story goes on from there in a not-so-pleasant way.
Right. I mean, the interesting thing is they don't have any evidence against Jesse Daniels. So, and I think the victim in this case did not want to perjure herself by changing the story. So what the prosecutor did was get together with the sheriff, the judge in this case, and also Jesse's public defender, who was a former prosecutor himself and very closely knit with this group. And they basically just they decide not to give him a trial. They just send him away to a mental institute and commit him against his will and just say he's insane, he can't defend himself. We'll throw him in Chattahoochee, which is where he stayed for the next 14 years of his life.
Was Willis McCall analogous to sheriffs perhaps all over the South at that time?
I think so. I think you know, at different levels, I think sheriffs often in the South were the most powerful people in town. They were answerable only to their electorate. So once they got put into power, they really just had to keep the electorate happy. And so sometimes they became more powerful than the local judges. Certainly with Willis McCall, that was the case. He could make or break political careers because of his influence. In his particular case, he lasted 28 years. Governors were afraid of Willis McCall because people thought he could bring governors down because he had so much on them. And so I think not always as powerful as Willis McCall, he was definitely one of the most powerful sheriffs in American history. But it was definitely a theme throughout the South that you had these sheriffs who really, really had their own fiefdoms.
Now, the landmark Brown versus Board of Education decision plays a significant role in both Devil in the Grove and now Beneath a Ruthless Sun. This decision was in 1954. We're set in December of 57. How is Brown used as a backdrop for what's going on in Florida and in other places in our country at that time?
Well, you know, what's interesting is after Brown versus Board, which is this landmark desegregation case where now the public schools are open to people of every race, there was a real blowback in the South at this time. All of a sudden, you saw a hardening of the racial disagreements that were happening. You saw a rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan. You saw these white citizen councils popping up throughout the South. Thurgood Marshall called them the Uptown Klan. They were lawyers, doctors, politicians, respectable people who sort of went about the agenda of the Ku Klux Klan, but they had the demeanor of a Rotary Club. And so this is what you saw in this particular case. Tensions were heightened. There was a disappearance of moderate politicians. You were either for segregation or against segregation. And so the big fear was the mixing of the races, miscegenation. It wasn't so much about black children getting educations. It was like, this is the first step. The next step, African Americans are going to be in our bedrooms, in our living rooms with our children. And that's the way it was looked at in the South. And so there was this general fear of this mixing of the races. And that was sort of the environment that allowed this very strange rape case to sort of fester.
You note, Gilbert, that if you were white and living in the Jim Crow South at this time, being labeled as someone who supported equal rights of African Americans was one of the worst things that could befall you.
Right, and that's what you see in this. I was wondering, like, this is a very odd way to look at race, this one particular criminal case in Beneath a Ruthless Sun. It sort of turns race on its head, and I was very curious about what was happening. But honestly, to support white supremacy, it poisoned all elements of society. If you were white and you were expected to perjure yourself in order to maintain white supremacy, with a sheriff like Willis McCall leaning on you, he was so powerful that he could run your businesses out of these counties. If you were a journalist and you wanted to report on civil rights abuses, you would be run out of town, often violently. The same thing with lawyers who wanted to take cases of civil rights. Back then, you would be discarded. You would be, you know, shunned in the communities for taking a case involving the equal rights of blacks. And so racism just poisoned society. It debased everybody. You know, it was a great Thurgood Marshall quote that said, you know, racism benefits no one. And honestly, that was what I really came away learning after researching this book.
What did Jesse Daniels' experience reveal about mental institutions and the biases that people with mental illness faced then and perhaps face now?
Well, I mean, I think especially back then, these places like Chattahoochee were just such horrible institutions. You were much better off ending up in a state jail rather than a mental institute, because you could never get out of a mental institute. The place was like they were just putting people on Thorazine and just doping them into stupors. They were doing forced lobotomies. They were doing electroshock therapy. So once you got in there, you were a victim of this, and it was very impossible to prove yourself sane after undergoing all this. And so Jesse, this, you know, teenage kid who's thrown in because he was facing criminal charges and deemed insane, he was thrown in the worst wards of Chattahoochee with you know, sexual deviants, murderers, rapist, everybody, and there was really very little supervision. So the things that he endured there, they don't show up in the hospital records, but when you talk to Jesse's mother, you can tell that they were severe.
The book is Beneath a Ruthless Sun, a true story of violence, race, and justice lost and found, from the remarkable Gilbert King. Gilbert, congratulations, and thank you for spending time with us.
My pleasure, Jim. Thanks for having me.
See you soon. And a reminder that WRKF is wrapping up our Spring Member Fest. Less than 14,000 left to gather for our fundraiser, and contribute today to help bring the campaign to a successful conclusion, and you'll automatically be entered into a drawing for a first-generation Amazon Echo plus a $50 Amazon gift card. If you're not a WRKF member or have not donated for some time, please donate today. Those who give at the $5 per month level can select as a thank you a light bulb key ring, and I have my WRKF coffee mug here. That's for $13 a month. You can show it off, and it's a 16-ounce stoneware mug in a beautiful teal color with a stunning, shimmery glaze. The bold WRKF logo matches the glossy cream-colored interior of the mug, and you can call 855 855-893-9753 to show your support for WRKF, and you'll be drinking in style with your WRKF 16-ounce stoneware mug. 855-893-WRKF. 855-893-9753. Until tomorrow, for Ali Baltazar, I'm Jim Inkster. Pleased you're listening at any time during the day, but especially at this time, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.